This is the Ron Bledsoe interview for F1 Engine Book for April 14th, 2007.
Our side of the, whatever they have an F1 engine, Frank calls and we go out there for pictures.
Air. That's just about pictures.
I have got great engine photos, from every angle, testing, being assembled, but trying to get personnel photos, maybe group shots or whatever, of any of the people who worked on the F1 program has been almost impossible so far. It's been very difficult for me. I guess it's because it's not something that was done. There are a lot of good photos of Von Braun and his management team, Arthur Rudolph, and others. But those who worked on the F1, I'd really like to put a face on the program as well, not just write about these people and quote them.
Well, let me give you some people that actually mean a lot on the F1 engine. But this is besides Frank Stewart and Sonny Hu.
Okay.
Sonny lived down the way, by the way.
Yes, that's true.
And Frank lives on the mountain.
Yes, he did move. They've only been in their place about 4 years.
But guys from Rocketdyne is, I'm maybe partial, but one of the finest companies. And back in that day, Rocketdyne had always attended some of the top engineers. Well, a guy named Ted Benham was a chief engineer for the F1 engine.
I've got his name.
Somebody mentioned Ted.
Yes, and Vince Wheelock.
Vince Wheelock, I don't know when he's there, but there's two guys, mm-hmm. I don't know whether they mentioned or not, but a guy named Stu Mulligan, who now lives in Michigan.
Okay.
Is a Rocketdyne guy. And if you get an opportunity, I haven't seen Stu in years, at least 30 years.
Okay.
But Stu is one of the top managers, from the engine standpoint, engine systems individual.
Okay.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And Ted Benham lived out in the LA area, and I don't know whether
Frank gave me his number.
Oh, he did?
818 area code, so I will be giving him a call.
Okay, and so Ted is a good man. And a guy named Bob Biggs.
Yes, I've seen him in print, but I'm not quite sure how to find him. Maybe Vince Wheelock will know where I can.
But Bob Biggs, he wrote up an article, an outstanding article,
yes,
on the SSMA.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, and
I think I've seen it.
So you've probably seen that.
In fact, he did make a presentation on the F1 at an AIAA conference
like that. And Bob Biggs, very talented musician.
Mm-hmm.
As well as an engineer.
Okay.
Okay.
And he's out in California.
Mm-hmm. As far as I know, I retired in 1995.
Okay.
Okay. And since I retired, I play a lot of golf.
That's what retirement's all about, isn't it?
I consult a little bit, but yeah. I haven't consulted since 2004, so.
Okay.
I enjoy golf too much.
Well, my dad really took to retirement.
He
enjoyed his time at DuPont, but when he retired, he was ready to retire. So, mm-hmm.
But I'm 74, so I'm a little bit younger than some of them.
Well, all right. So how old were you when you came to Marshall then?
When I came to Marshall, I came.
What year was that?
I came from Aerojet General Corporation.
Yeah.
Which was built the Titan engines.
Yes,
XLR,
that's right.
XLR-91 and XLR-87.
And they tried to build the M1.
Titan engines. And I loved it out there. We lived out there 3.5 years.
Where out with Aerojet?
Sacramento.
Sacramento. Yes, it is beautiful.
Yeah. And so we came here in October of 1960. 1960,
mm-hmm.
And that's when I started working.
And that's when Marshall.
Marshall actually started in July of 1960.
That's right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so I came to work for a guy named Jerry Thompson, mm-hmm. and above him, who was a section chief at that time was a guy named Alex McCool. Alex McCool just had last fall had a series with UAH. You know, he was the shuttle program manager before he retired.
Mm-hmm.
He retired a couple of years
ago. And he's in his
80s. And he's in his 80s. He didn't retire until he reached 80.
Exactly.
And so then above him was a guy named Hans Paul.
I've heard of it. Yes.
He
I has just heard
since that wonderful German. He died.
Mm-hmm.
And then Willie Morozik, I don't know where you...
That name...
Willie Morozik was actually the head of the lab.
Okay.
Okay? He was the head of the lab.
Propulsion lab?
Propulsion lab.
Okay.
And they called, back in that day, they called it Propulsion and Vehicle Engineering Lab.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then above him was Dr. Von Ron. You know, he... this was an...
It was a fabulous management system. I've been doing a lot of studying on that because I have a chapter in managing the F-1 program and managing the S-1C
right.
program, because originally I was going to write about the engine and then realized that these two are really part of a system, both the F-1 and the S-1C stage.
Yeah.
So I'm going to incorporate that, and
okay.
and includes management of the F-1 program, which includes Sonny. And management of the S-1C stage, but it also incorporates how NASA at the head, but also Marshall, how that management and how the lab structure was set up, and basically how Marshall does programs.
Right, right. Well, I was 47 years old
okay.
when I came to Marshall.
Okay.
Okay. And the year after, I mean, since I came in October, and I think it was the next year, back in that day, Von Braun actually sent a, you know, sent down and said, get some young engineer to go and I have to make a speech. They'll ask for a speech.
Okay.
So I went up and made a speech on the early Saturn days.
Okay.
To the automobile industry in Buffalo, New York.
Okay.
With another friend of mine.
I know the SAE. Publishes a lot of aerospace papers.
Yeah.
Because a lot of mechanical engineers just, that's a good venue for them.
Right, and that was a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then another thing that since we, Lewis Research Center.
Mm-hmm. Now Glenn.
Back in that day, so now it's Glenn. Was very, had some of the top engineers in injector development for the F-1 engine, as well as the SSME, and also the turbopump. So we actually went up in 61, Jerry Thompson and I went up to there and early there to talk to a guy named Dick Preen. I don't know whether Dick Preen is still there. Dick Preen was a, what I would say, quote, an expert in the field of combustion instability and injector development. Okay. That was a long time ago. Dick was probably maybe a few years older than I was.
Mm-hmm.
And they had also top turbopump machinery guys up in Lewis, which is that place. I don't know whether that...
You know, it's very interesting. I spoke with their historian out there, archivist, where out at NASA Glenn, told her what I was working on. And she can't dig up a thing when it comes to... And I've heard what you're mentioning.
Right.
But she cannot find the paper trail that shows all this preliminary work that Lewis did on the engine.
Okay, let me give you... I don't know whether you have a book or not, Anthony, but
okay.
I can. This is. Have you seen this book?
That I have, but you've got a hardcover edition.
And I've got a hardcover. This is.
Those are collectible.
By the way.
It's a great book. Bilstein did a fabulous job, and it's considered a reference. Still considered,
and it's still a good reference.
It sure is.
On the F1, the cryogenics, you know, as far as the hydrogen, I mean, as far as oxygen and kerosene engine, which was the F1 engine, it had, it still has excellent material in here.
Yes.
Okay.
It does.
And so it, in fact, it mentions Jerry Thompson in here, and it mentions Dick Crane.
Okay.
And some of the Lewis fellows.
Okay.
Okay. And that's why I mentioned, because Lewis, back in that day, working with Marshall, we called on those guys, and we worked with them. Now, another guy here at Marshall, who worked in the test lab during this time, but who later became the program manager for the SSMA, was a guy named Otto Goetz.
Okay.
Okay? I don't know whether anybody's mentioned Otto.
No.
Otto has a farm out in Newmarket, I think. And Otto is a, they do call on him even today, I think. And Otto is a real fine German. He's a, he is not one of the original 118
or what?
18 or what have you.
Various numbers.
But he's not there.
Okay.
But this gives you, you know, mention some of the people, the Princeton. Also, you know, we went to Princeton, called upon the Princeton people.
Yeah, I heard when they had instability problems, they were pulling in universities, whatever they, what assets they could get their hands on to look at the problem.
Oh, yeah. And they came down, as far as instability is concerned, we put valves in there, and some of the smartest testing in, you know.
Rocketdyne had a very exhaustive program.
And they had very exhaustive, and hey, that, we saw that, and in 1966, she and I and my three children, who are long gone, got it far from here.
Yeah.
But those, we went out to Edwards Air Force Base, and that test stand, we qualified the F-1 engine, and we went out in July and came back in August. It took 6 weeks to develop that, and, but by that time we had actually, you know, solved the instability problem, as you know. You know, from a history standpoint, 67 or 68, we won a moonshot in 69. But we launched in 67, 68.
Yeah, it's true.
And that aspect. Of course, we used the AH-1 engine. And Marshall was constructed back in that day so that a young guy like myself was sort of like a project engineer for the F-1 engine. We had a project engineer for the H-1 engine.
Yes, sir.
We had a project engineer for the J-2 engine and
the RL-10, I think.
And the RL-10 was also, in fact, J.R. Thompson. You heard of J.R. J.R. is, of course, he goes to church down here at Southwood. I mean, I think Jeff Woodard. But anyway, J.R. is an interesting individual. Of course, he heads up Oracle Sciences, as you probably know.
No, I don't.
J.R. is, he came to us and got his master's at Alabama while he was working with us.
Okay.
As just a grunt, just like we were.
Okay.
And J.R. is, has gone on to, you know, to really develop, you know, a lot for the space industry and working for Orbiter Science Corporation. But he heads that up here in Huntsville.
Okay. One of the questions I posed to Sonny, because I want to understand the level of development Rocketdyne had on this engine when not just NASA acquired it in 58, but when Marshall acquired it in 60, I believe, the program. Basically, NASA headquarters gave it to Marshall to develop. What do you remember about the level of development by Rocketdyne? Because they really, they did their paper study starting, I think, in 55, for the Air Force, and I'll have to speak with some of the other Rocketdyne guys to learn just the extent of the hardware development was by the time they began working with Marshall on the engine. What do you remember about that?
On the airport engine, it was much more, the development program was much more extensive on the SSMA. You know, we went...
Really?
Yeah. But for the F1 engine, when we got through, we went through what we call a preliminary flight readiness test.
Yes.
And, okay, mm-hmm. and the qual test.
Yes.
Which is 6 weeks. But what I remember as far as development, we tested a lot at Edwards Air Force Base.
Mm-hmm.
That test stand was put in, if I remember, it was sanctioned and actually
I think
constructed
it was,
in 61.
Yes, Harold Hall gave me photographs dated from 61. I don't have the months in front of me.
Yeah.
But that actually show F1 test taking place in as early as May of 61.
Yeah.
So, yeah, at least that. But I'm I guess I'll eventually find out.
And we tested out here at Marshall, too.
Yes.
You know.
First in a converted Saturn 1 stand, the dual position sat, from what I understand. It's
right.
A dual position S1 Saturn test stand. One of position was converted for F1 testing until the dedicated F1 test stand
right.
was finished.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's
and
right.
then, of course, there's the S1C static testing.
Yeah, the S1C, yeah, right. Okay. As far as the development program is concerned, I can't remember, you know, as far as the number of tests
oh, that's
laid out and all of that. And I have it somewhere. I mean, I have all of that history. In fact, I used to. But I, probably on the SSMA, I have every notebook starting in 1970. But on the Saturdays, I don't have all of that,
okay.
you know, from 1960 to 1970. Say there was 10 years there
mm-hmm.
that I didn't take and just jot down every book I had. And I don't know what I did with those books.
Well, do you recall when any significant meetings that really stand out in your mind when you were trying to work through these problems? And how far did it go? Was Von Braun involved in any of these things? Or?
Oh, yes. In
okay.
fact, as far as the combustion instability
mm-hmm.
is concerned, that went all the way to headquarters. And who was the guy that was trying to think who the guy that told Von Braun me, he came in and said, hey, you know, we need to take and maybe we need to change. You know, change gears.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Von Braun and Rocketdyne and Marshall King said, hey, you know, that'll delay us even more because what they were pushing toward was the moonshot. Okay. And they were really pushing. And I remember vividly the, you know, the meetings that we had. And we had meetings constantly on the combustion instability problem. In fact, that was at Rocketdyne. We had program review every 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and you know, during that time, when you picked up the phone and called Rocketdyne and says, "I need," this is a suggestion. I think you did. They took a change order back in that day and implemented. They did not on the SSME. Due to the money situation, Rocketdyne no longer would do. In other words, you went through a contract. I mean, they said, when you deliver me that money, I will change that. But during the Saturdays,
yeah.
then that was not a problem.
Okay.
During the Saturdays, NASA, up until 1966, we lived without a without a
very few constraints.
Very few constraints.
Yes.
And Rocket Knight and us work and Marshall very close together. The Washington D.C. people got in very little.
Mm-hmm.
They were, you know, would talk to Von Braun in that way, and Von Braun would come down and talk to Dr. Mrazek, and you know, that way. But the young guys like myself, you know, we'd never get into I think Dr. Von Braun's leadership was such that he handled that himself. Later on, that was not the case, you know. But the things I remember most was the combustion engine voting problem on the F1 engine and the turbopump problem. We constantly worked with Lewis Research Center. We also worked with Princeton University. We had top-notch engineers at Rocket and I, and they were heavily working those problems there. And to me, coming in at 7 o'clock in the morning and working till, you know, at night, you never thought about it. It never bothered you.
I heard that from a lot of people. I heard that from the folks who worked on the rover program at GM. It's just the hours everybody was working were ridiculous, and it was a sacrifice for a lot of people, but it's like it wasn't an issue. They were really driven. They were really motivated. It was a magnificent goal, and everybody was focused on that.
And the wives, you know, they didn't have a problem. But that's what I remember, though.
Yeah.
Some of the key things. And like Bill Brunnen and the Rocket Act guys at Tim Benham was mm-hmm. you know, good project. And we had, I can't remember their names, I knew that as far as engine system people are concerned, Bob Big was an outstanding performance,
mm-hmm.
you know, engineer
mm-hmm.
that we worked with in part problems. But the F1 was, you know, for 1.5 million pounds of thrust, and being able to put 5 of those for 7.5 million pounds of thrust, it was really exciting. That was the most exciting time. I mean, you loved going to work. You loved mm-hmm. going to work. You come home. And the wives, you know, they never did things as we said. They just raised the kids. Keep moving.
Well, you know, they're unsung heroes, really. I really think. A lot of these men. I don't know how many. Do you encounter any women engineers at all? It's interesting. I saw this little Alabama TV documentary down at the Marshall History Office, and one of the women, there was a woman involved in the Apollo program who's in her 80s now, but apparently the documentary was done within the last 10 years, but she was one of the first female technical illustrators to work at Marshall.
Yeah.
And she was extremely good at it. And she'd get out there when she had a question, put her hard hat out, go out to the floor, and got down and dirty with whatever it is she had.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know her name, but she was involved, but I guess the vast majority were men working on the program.
The majority of the people working on Saturn was men.
Mm-hmm.
Today, there's a lot of women involved in the
mm-hmm.
program.
Mm-hmm.
But the exciting time was when you had ideas at Marshall. Guys like Dr. Von Braun would actually listen to all the facets, and he was smart enough to be able to take and work with all the people on the decisions that were made. But the decisions made in the engine area
mm-hmm.
rarely went all the way up.
I understand.
Well,
apparently he left people to do their job,
right.
Both the managers and the engineers.
Yeah.
And if something came up, then he'd get involved. You know.
We were never confronted with what I would say management you know, on our backs.
Mm-hmm.
The people that were allowed to do their job and enjoy solving problems.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the enjoyment mm-hmm. as a young engineer. We enjoyed solving problems and being left alone to solve those problems.
Yes.
And the managers would take it and say, hey, you know, we've solved the problem, or this is where we're hitting, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Marshall is known for, especially in the 60s, for its laboratory structure.
Right.
I think there were like 10 laboratories or thereabouts. Was the laboratory devoted to propulsion involved in building mock-ups or testing of, say, the injector or the turbo pump in order for that? Because it seemed that's how Marshall always worked. They always got the laboratories involved in either the design and development or in the problem resolution. Do you know if they built, if they worked with the labs themselves worked with Rocketdyne or?
Oh yeah.
To work on that?
Yeah, and they would. From my standpoint, what we were remembering, Herman Widener, who was the deputy, I don't want to hear.
No, that I don't. It hasn't. That didn't ring a bell.
Herman Widener was a deputy Dr. William Morozik.
Yes, I've seen that name. Yes.
Okay. Herman Widener was one of the best propulsion people, outstanding leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a deputy, and he came down and Hans Paul.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was over Hans Paul and. Then Hans Paul went down to Alex McCoo, and now Alex McCoo and Jerry Thompson, and down to a young engineer like
okay.
himself. And, but Herman Widener really worked very close with us. He was one of the guys that worked very close with us because he knew propulsion. Herman Widener left in the 70s to go back to Germany. To be a professor in Germany because I feel like he was pushed out, and I don't know whether you want to get into.
Well, look, I want to say this. You can say something as part of a telling of a story. But if there are things that are off the record, they're off the record. I just won't include them. But if you want to fill in the blank.
I think Dr. Bertrand was sent in from the administration during that time to clean house on the Germans.
And he certainly did, didn't he?
And he did a sorry,
Yeah. How could he toss up Eberhard Rees? I mean, he's doing a great job, you know?
Our German people here
mm-hmm.
did more for this country and more for this city and more for this space business than anybody, and I'll take up for them any.
I think what Washington did to Arthur Rudolph is a travesty.
Yeah, it was a travesty.
A brilliant man. He knew propulsion inside and out. A good manager.
Yeah.
And I've read that part of the story. I interviewed a colonel named Mr. Winterstein.
Uh-huh.
It was one of the original Army team that helped to bring in the team members from Germany into White Sands and all that, and got to know the team, Von Braun personally, and what you'll read about is how Von Braun was ambivalent about should he pursue what he wanted to do or go to private industry.
Right.
At that time, and what Mr. Winterstein told me is that he convinced Von Braun that if he left the field, the Army held the best possibility for him to try to achieve his goal of maximizing launch vehicle size and whatever to pursue this, because he was always interested in space exploration, either satellites or manned or whatever.
Right, right.
We know that.
Yeah.
Because Von Braun had doubts. He knew that private industry paid better. He wasn't making a lot of money working for the Army. And after serving his stint, his requirement, he was just talking out loud, and Winterstein's rank at the time was colonel.
Yeah.
And It's really an amazing story how one person can have an impact on the direction, basically the direction of history in this case.
Oh, yeah.
He convinced him. He said, Werner, if you leave the Army and you go to something else, you can kiss the moon goodbye. Those were his exact words.
Yeah.
And he's in his 80s as well. And he told me this story. He even remembers it was La Hacienda restaurant out on the patio over dinner. And they were talking about this.
Yeah.
True story. And Von Braun thought about it and came back to him later, said, we're going to stay. We'll stick with it. And he also convinced them to keep the German team together. There were so many brilliant German engineers in that whole thing.
Yeah.
The guidance, the propulsion, the electronics, anything you can imagine. He said, if the team breaks up, that'll... I don't know. Winterstein had a sense of the possible.
Oh, yeah.
He really saw post-war what America could do in space exploration.
Oh, yeah.
I think he had a handle on it. So he encouraged him as much as possible to just hang in there. And, of course, the rest
Everhard
is history.
Reed, some of the Germans, I mean, and Hermann Weiner,
uh-huh.
as far as propulsion is concerned, was one outstanding.